Three companies now control 90% of the world's seeds and the future of its food. Some think it not so smart to have so many eggs in so few baskets, and they want 1 million people to start saving their own seeds. That leads us to ask, can saving seeds save our future?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1176th edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Santiago who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Folks, not too long ago, farmers saved the best seeds from this year's crop to plant next year's crop. By selecting the best seeds year after year, decade after decade, farmers were able to develop crops that were best suited to their own farms in their own environments. The crops grown from carefully selected seeds would grow much better than the store-bought seeds simply because they knew how. The store-bought seeds, which were raised somewhere else by somebody else for something else, came up out of the ground as strangers in a strange land. The crops farmers selected and developed for themselves also had something else going for them. We may as well call that something else character. Farmers selected for character because it helped them get an edge on their competition in the marketplace. Who wants to eat bland uniformity when you can eat character? And so it was for 10,000 years, give or take. Then in 1980, the U.S. Supreme Court decided that private companies could patent the genetic intelligence of plants. Far-thinking entrepreneurs saw the Supreme Court ruling as a way to gain control of the world's supply of seeds and the future of its food, and so they started buying up seed companies. Today, three big seed companies control 90% of the world's seeds, and thus the future of its food. Some look at this consolidation and see danger. What if, they ask, something goes wrong? After all, things usually do go wrong. And so they have begun a campaign to get 1 million people to start saving seeds, their own seeds. This campaign to save the seeds leads us to ask, can saving seeds save our future? Who better to ask than the seed guy himself, Bill McDorman, Executive Director of Rocky Mountain Seed Alliance. Bill, welcome to the Food Chain. So pleased to have you aboard.
Thank you, Michael. I'm honored to be here.
Yeah, so I met you in the pages of my favorite newspaper, Acres USA. And you know, the article introduced you in a very interesting way. It caught my attention. They introduced you as a 25-year-old college freshman at the University of Montana in Missoula, asking himself the question, where am I going to get seeds that will grow here? Wow. I, of course, picked up on that because I'm a Montana boy myself. But I was wondering, why were you interested in growing a garden at 25 in Missoula, Montana?
Well, I had just enrolled at the University of Montana. I was coming back to college, which made my father real happy. I'd taken a couple years off. And I had saved some money working, and so I bought a house. I bought a little old house on the north side of Missoula. And lo and behold, I figured out after I bought the house that one of the most famous gardens in the neighborhood, Mrs. Sorge's garden, was in my backyard. I purchased one of the old railroad families, they called them, houses. And those were the people first into that whole big Missoula Valley, and they lived where they did because it was the best place to garden in the valley.
On the north side of the valley meant you had the south-facing slope, right?
Right. I think the snow melted off where we were earlier, you know, so we had a longer season, and some of those low, you know, the frost that gathered in around the lower land near the river in the valley, you know, missed us. And so it was just natural, I think, that these folks looked out over the valley and went, wow, this is the best place to garden.
And there you
go. So I had been a gardener, and I wanted to I wanted to grow my own for the first time. I got to grow my own garden. You know, it wasn't my parents. I didn't have to share with my sisters. You know, I could decide the whole thing. And so that gave rise to that question. What do I plant? How do I find the best seeds?
And you're in Missoula, Montana. So who propagates or who develops seeds for Missoula, Montana?
Well, you know, when you start asking around, you find out that nobody, you know, this was the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s. Nobody was then. But there were varieties that the people, some of the other old railroad families, had grown in the past that knew about, that said were better, that had disappeared. Some had been in catalogs, but some had disappeared. And that, you know, I sort of uncovered this story that a lot of the specificity, the old varieties that had been available, even in commercial catalogs, in each little region of the country, were starting to disappear. And so that got me looking, well, what's left? What could we find? And so that set me out on this journey to find the best seeds for my garden. And I guess it's a journey now, 35 years later, I'm still on.
Wow, 35 years chasing seeds, right?
Yeah, I never dreamed it would take that, you know, that I would still be here. I thought I was going to go to law school, actually.
There you go.
And I got so...
That's one of the things I really want to pick up as we go through this conversation is how we can best affect change in the world. Can we do it by becoming an attorney, a lawyer, a politician, or can we do it through the soil and its seeds? That's kind of where I would like to go as we go through this. But first, I would like you to describe what it's like to grow plants in the Rocky Mountains. I mean, we're down here in the beautiful Monterey Bay area. You can take a seed and throw it out there and you get 100 plants. It's amazing, you know. Right. But not so much up in the high country, because you have two things to deal with up there that we don't have here. One of them is altitude, and the other is latitude.
Yes, and they both affect what's going on. So I grew up at 6,000 feet in the mountains of central Idaho at about the 44th parallel. And it was somebody... called me up one time. I ended up starting a little seed company called High Altitude Gardens. Its goal was to find seeds that would work at 6,000 feet in Idaho, and you know, from all over the world. I've just wanted to find as many things as I could that would work there. And somebody called me up one time and said, "Well, what's your growing season there?" You know, because that's what we always ask people before. So, and
34 minutes, right?
Yeah. Well, that year. And I had had 9 frosts and 2 hailstorms in between Memorial Day and Labor Day. And that was the worst year I ever remember. We had 9 inches of snow one time on the 4th of July. So when you ask about problems growing in the mountains, that can be your problem. And so, you know, there are workarounds, and we grew a lot of stuff. And if you're smart and you start designing how your garden's laid out, and you have a few of the modern tools. We had these things called Walla Waters. We started with row covers, and then we built these passive solar greenhouses, and we learned what to plant in them and what we could leave out in the snow, like carrots, that would never get hurt, even if it frosted. You know, once you learn your way around, you can grow quite a bit of food, but that's what it took, was some experience and some experimentation. And then the most important thing was finding the right seeds.
And who on earth would develop seeds for 6,000 feet up in the Idaho or Montana Rockies? Nobody.
Well, you know, it was surprising. It turns out there was a 200-year-old seed company from Japan called Sakata, which is still around.
They're right here in the Monterey Bay area. Yeah.
Right. They're owned by one of the gene giants that you talked about. They're not an independent company anymore, but they were when I got started. Anyway, they did trials at a really high elevation, it turns out, on Mount Fuji in Japan, early in their history. You know, Japan's a pretty far north place.
It is.
And has some elevation. And so one of the favorites that ended up, it's still one of my favorite carrots, is called Kinko 6-inch. And so that became one of the favorites for people in the Mountain West, and it's still being passed around and is available. So, you know, that's just one example. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're around, you know, I own high altitude.
You really start looking for the special kinds of plants that can survive that special kind of environment. And there's not many, but they're out there, right?
Well, you know, I ran my little company for 28 years. Before I was done, we had about 200 different varieties of vegetables. You know, I gained most fame by going to Siberia and bringing back Siberian tomatoes, which sort of fits with this theme, you know.
Did they taste good?
Oh, they're the best. They're superior. Okay. In the same period, you know, let me add one thing. In the same period in our country, when we developed a commercial tomato industry and we learned how to machine harvest tomatoes, ship them an average 1,300 miles, and get them to look good on grocery store shelves for 2 weeks, Siberians were locked behind the Iron Curtain.
Seeds from Siberia. Tomatoes from Siberia. And you were talking about the difference between those tomatoes that were locked behind the Iron Curtain and ours. Go ahead, Bill McDorman.
Yes. And so it gets back to what you said at the beginning of the show, and farmers saving and selecting their own seeds and having character. Every Siberian gardener I met, and I just did rough calculations that there were over 2 million of them. Everybody in the Soviet Union in the 80s had access to a garden plot. It was part of being a state citizen. And they were not only a garden, but they were allowed to build a little summer cabin, lots of them on these plots. They called them their dachas. And so everyone had a dacha, every family, and everybody had a garden. And the only way to get tomato seeds was to save their own. And so they did. And so you can imagine at that point, it was about a 68-year period. They had been growing and saving their own Siberian tomatoes from the seeds of plants that tasted the best for them. That was their own.
They were selecting. They were selecting for that character, weren't they?
Why save seeds if they don't taste good? It's just natural. And so that was a genetics laboratory for the selection of flavor that the world will probably never recreate. It's gone now. Those same big Gene Giant and Western catalogs are in Siberia. And they're buying the same crap, I will lovingly call it, that all the rest of us have been, sort of wash-brained into buying, that's available in the Western world. But at the time, when I went there, it was still behind the Iron Curtain. And all they had were their own, and they were so delicious. It was incredible, and they still are to this day. In fact, as you know, modern plant breeders want to bring flavor in to our modern crops. That's where they're looking into Russian and Siberian tomatoes for flavor.
Those that were locked up behind the Iron Curtain and therefore, you know, did not have access to the new way of doing things. You know, when I was writing my book, Metro Farm, I had been following the Dacha gardening of Soviet Union. And my father-in-law was going to Moscow to visit. And I pleaded with him, please, please go visit a Moscow farmer's market so I can have a photograph or two for my book, Metro Farm. And he did. And while he was there taking photographs at the farmer's market in the Soviet Union's Moscow, he got arrested for taking pictures of a farmer's market. So they let him go eventually, but, you know, he came back with a pretty good story, right?
Wow. Well, you know, you can imagine what happened to me. I got to Siberia, and fantasized with, I asked if I could bring seeds back, you know, because here's all these incredible tomatoes. And I was in the season where there were seeds all over. And I was told, no, you cannot. You need permission from Leningrad. And I was 5,000 miles away from Leningrad.
On the other side of the world.
Well, it would, you know, I quickly figured out the Soviet Union was 13 time zones wide. And I had traveled on this Trans-Siberian Railroad 5 time zones. I mean, that's bigger than the whole U.S.
Yeah.
And so I'm out in the middle of nowhere. There's no way to get permission. And then I thought, I'm going to get arrested if I try to sneak seeds out of here. You know, that's really what would happen. And I decided personally I wasn't going to do it until a lab tech at this at a center, a horticultural center there, actually slipped me the seeds to about 60 Siberian tomatoes. It was all their trials and testing, descriptions, wow. little drawings, pictures, everything. She wanted to share that bounty. She knew how important diversity was, and she wanted the world to know the work that they'd done. And so this was an era of glasnost and perestroika. I think people were awakening. They were taking chances, and I happened to be the first guy in there from the West. We were the first Western travelers allowed into this Center for Horticulture. And so I was chosen.
I'm so jealous.
reluctantly as the guy to help share this with the West. And so I brought them out. I grew them out in my own trials and testing. We had them all tested for there's no diseases. After a couple of years, I started releasing them. And I think their last count, I looked, there were about 24 of those 60 varieties are still in commercial circulation in seed companies and catalogs all over the world, the Western world, from Africa, everywhere. So, and that's just a gift of the Siberians to the rest of us.
So while the Siberians were locked up behind the Iron Curtain, what were we doing with our tomato seeds?
Yeah, well, we were making sure that only commercial varieties were available and that largely didn't taste good. I mean, that wasn't you could almost argue all of the energy being put into tomatoes from after World War II in our country. I'm generalizing, and there's always exceptions, most of the research being done in universities and for companies was so that, as I said, you could machine harvest them, you could truck them long ways without them, you know, deconstructing or getting smushed, and that they would look good on a grocery store shelf. They had long shelf life. Nobody ever selected for flavor. That wasn't the highest commercial value. And it is astounding how well our tomatoes do that. It just shows you how good plant breeding can be. They just had a different goal.
Sure. And they did good for what they were trying to do, because they could make tomatoes you could pick in California and ship to Boston, and they would be red. And they didn't really taste like much, but they were red and they were beautiful, kind of like red delicious apples, the same way, right?
Yeah, you can see what commercial. I loved your introduction talking about character. You know, those that have been closer to the land, that have always grown their own crops and eaten some of that food, and then saved the seeds for the highest values that they saw. And sometimes they were religious values. Yeah. Sometimes they were cultural values and stories and history. And sometimes it was just raw flavor like the Siberians, you know. But whatever it was, it made them different and made them endemic to that place. And that creates diversity. And it's diversity that we need. You know, that if you have more diversity, you have a better chance of the changes that we see coming. And so that's why it's so important. And so, you know, to get back to the million seed saver thing, that's why we came up with this idea. And it's not as far-fetched as you think. We may have 100 to 150 million gardeners already in this country. These are people that grow something, if not in their yard, on their deck or their trailer in a pot or whatever. But it's the number one outdoor hobby in America after bird watching.
And much more effective than antidepressants, by the way.
Well, we're learning that. We're getting the data, aren't we? It's really
We
it's
certainly
really
are. So, it gets right down to it. Yes, we are. Coming to grips with that. Yeah.
So I figure by telling stories and inspiring people and showing them how easy it really is to save things like tomato seeds, all you do is save them, right? We can reawaken something that was in our population, our gardening and farming population, less than two generations ago. I mean, I'm not dreaming of doing something new. I'm dreaming of something that's already done still in many parts of the rest of the world, even Siberia, and something that we used to do in America. And so that's where the million
and something that we did for 10,000 years. It's what we did. It's how we got by for 10,000 years. Is by taking the best from what we did and saving it for next year.
Well, and that really, if you think about it, is how we created the food we have. Most of the breeding work, the technical, what we would call the technical breeding work that brought wild plants that were largely inedible, things like teosinte for corn or chiltepines for peppers, or, you know, you can go on and on, or a wild mustard that became our brassicas, our cabbage family. All of those plants didn't look anything like the foods that we have now.
Before we started working on them, before selecting them, before we started choosing. Hey, we're with Bill McDermott, who is the seed man up there in the Rocky Mountains. We're talking about seeds. We're talking about starting a million people collecting their own seeds so that we can make it through whatever comes next. Do stay tuned. We will be right back. Going to talk about politics.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
And Bill McDermott, the seed man, the executive director of Rocky Mountain Seed Alliance, and about 40 other organizations that Bill started along the way in his career of seed collecting. So many of them, it's just amazing the number of organizations that you started. And it sounds like you're like the Johnny Appleseed of seeds. Am I wrong?
Well, you know, I got infected at the University of Montana and realized that I really believe this to this day, and I want to send this out to everybody. I still don't believe that the institutions that we will need to survive well into the future have been created yet. Uh-huh. Most of the ones I see are moribund. They're raising money just to keep themselves going, or they're corporations that have a real short-term profit motivation. I'm not bad-mouthing either, and we need everything we've got working. But what we really need are nimble, quick, and effective, what I would call grassroots organizations, to change things like seed saving. And so that's what the Rocky Mountain Seed Alliance has become for me. It's just a new attempt to try to get things moving quickly, you know, by focusing on the right things.
Well, I became focused on seeds, I guess, refocused, as it were, being a Montana farm boy. How can you get away from it? But I was giving a speech a few years back, at the Catholic Rural Life Conference in Missouri. And got up really early in the morning and decided to go across the street to the cafe and have breakfast before things got up and running. And there was a farmer sitting in there all by himself, and I knew he was a farmer because I know farmers, and he was a farmer. So I went over there and asked if I could sit down and join him, and he said, well, sure. And turns out he was speaking at the conference as well about his seeds. Name was Percy Smizer.
And he was Percy.
Yes, and yeah. He was a canola farmer from Bruno, Saskatchewan, who was being sued by the Monsanto Corporation because one day, Percy woke up to the fact that the canola in his barrel pit that he sprayed with Roundup didn't die. And he called up a neighbor and said, look at this. What's going on? And the neighbor said, you've got Monsanto seeds in your field. And Monsanto sued him for stealing his seeds. And he didn't buy any seeds. He didn't steal them. They just bounced off a truck that rolled down the road someplace, and there they were. But from that, I followed Percy for years in his fight with Monsanto Corporation. And when you say that saving seeds is essentially a political act, and monumentally so now, is it not, with just three companies owning everything?
Oh, yes. It's become political. You know, what we try to stay focused on is underneath that is the biological diversity reason. You know, I would even argue this for Monterey and your peninsula is that, you know, Monsanto and ChemChina, you know, which bought Syngenta,
yeah,
and DowDuPont don't have anything on their dockets for creating new crops and the millions of dollars of research they do for Monterey. You're a fringe climate also. You know, they're only going for the largest, most profitable markets. And so by doing that, there's no diversity being created or kept alive in your area, unless the people there grow and save their own seeds, any more than there is in Ketchum, Idaho, where I grew up. And so by keeping focused on that, you know, we kind of stay underneath the mantle of those politics, but make no mistake, this is a hugely political act, and we will feel the brunt of that. There will be policy changes proposed in our own government that will try to make it more and more difficult for people to grow and save their own seeds. You know, for example, a bill has just been introduced in Canada that for the first time would charge every farmer a royalty for saving their own seeds.
What? Wait a minute. Whoa. Wait a minute. If you save your own seeds from somebody, from the seeds that somebody else owns the patent on, then you pay a royalty, right?
No. This is your own seeds from your own varieties. And they have a date of the newer varieties. They just have, I think the date they charged was 2014. If the varieties that you got from 2014 or later, didn't matter who, whether it was patented or not, if you save seeds from your own varieties, you would have to pay a royalty. And the reason they're doing this, and last time I did some research on the Monsanto website, and the language was there. One of their arguments was that it is unfair. It is unfair if a farmer can grow and save their own seeds when every other farmer has to buy their own seeds. It's just unfair to those farmers that have to buy their own seeds. And so this is a policy move. And what they really want to do is, with those royalties, is further research for all seed farmers and whatever. You know, they want to put all that money into a big pool that could be used for research to develop new varieties for all the farmers. So they say it's for a good reason. But still, the idea that a farmer for the first time in history would have to pay royalties on their own seed, well, as you can well imagine, is causing quite a stir. Now, this is not unusual, these kinds of policies, not that you would have to pay royalties, but that it would actually be illegal for you to save your own seeds, are policies that are furthered all the time in the third world, especially in Africa countries right now, through the WTO and some of its trade, the furtherance of its intellectual property rights in that have to be adhered to if you want to join the World Trade Organization now. There's all sorts of stuff going on. So I think our brother and sister farmers and gardeners in other countries have actually faced into this political reality, or had to, more than we have in the United States and Canada up to this point. But I just don't believe it's going to be long until that happens. And so, you know, I personally try not to fight battles until I really have to. And in the U.S. right now, we don't have to. We have open field running for growing and saving all the seeds that we want of our own. We just have to be really smart about the seeds we start with. You can't start with patented seeds. And sometimes it's a little difficult to find out what is patented and what is not. And so that can be a problem, and I can talk about that. But once you get going, you can grow, save, and share your own seeds. Right now, we can do that.
But they're coming for us. But they're coming for us, right? Am I wrong?
Well, you know, trust in Allah, but tie up your camel.
There you go. Well, it's just the notion of having to pay a royalty on the seeds that you save for yourself is just absolutely mind-boggling. It's so hard to believe that they, the big seed companies and the government that they really do control, would actually put that on the table. But they are in Canada. You say this is for real.
Just in the last couple of weeks, UC Canada, let's see, I'm trying to think of the organizations. I think if you'll just Google up some of the news stories that are starting to surface. But this is a real, you know, whether it has a realistic chance of passing or whatever, but it's an arrogant move. And I saw Vandana Shiva, the great seed champion from India, one time give a speech. And she was talking about this kind of arrogance. And she goes, think about how arrogant that is. That you know, number one, that you can pat a plant, you can patent life itself.
And then you can own it, and then you can make them pay for it. We're going to have to take a quick break, Bill. Right back, folks. Do stay tuned. Bill McDermott, Executive Director, Rocky Mountain Seed Alliance, and the seed guy. And so when it gets right down to it, saving your own seeds is a deeply political move on your part. You're really taking on the powers that be who want you to be subservient to what their products happen to be. If you're saving your own seeds, that means that you are in control of the food of your future. If you must rely on them, they are in control. Does that about sum it up, Bill?
That does. You know, Vonda Nachiva, who I spoke about, has a really wonderful book about democracy. And what she would argue, you know, the India has 55 million farmers. It's the country, half the world's farmers live in India. And they're relatively small scale. I mean, what she does is punch through this myth that these three big biotech companies are going to feed 9 billion people. And it's grounded in the reality that over 75% of the world's food, we're starting to get good statistics, is created on farms that are less than 2 hectares or less. That's about 5 acres or less.
Okay, repeat that one more time, just for emphasis.
It's hard to measure, but up to 75% of the food that's actually consumed on the planet is grown on farms of 5 acres or less. About 75% of those 5-acre plots are family-owned. They are smallholder farmers. They are part of this 55 million farmers that live in India. And what she points out is that if they give in to Monsanto in India, and Monsanto owns their seed supply for all these farmers, their ability to be free, to act accordingly in a democracy and to have a vote on any level will be gone. It's a real practical thing for her. And so, yeah, if you want to have your own freedom, then you're going to have to control some semblance of your own food system. Otherwise, you'll be hungry. And if you don't control your food system, you're not going to have a say. And I think that's kind of her logic. And so, Ben, this is so controlling seeds and patenting them is really arrogant, and charging royalties. Well, she said, well, you know how arrogant that is? That's just about as arrogant as jumping off a boat from Europe onto the eastern shores of North America for the first time as a Spanish explorer, walking onto shore with a flag, sticking it into the ground and saying, I hereby claim that all of North America is now owned by the King and Queen of Spain.
Well,
right? How arrogant is that?
That's certainly audacious, is it not?
That's the same thing we're seeing today with seeds.
Bill, what exactly are those three seed companies? What kind of food are they making for the future? What are they doing? If they're not developing seeds for us here in Monterey or somebody else in Albuquerque or somebody else in Ketchum, Idaho, what are they doing?
Well, it's hard to say. What we do know they're doing is they're all under tremendous pressure to make sure that their next quarterly profit statement looks good for their shareholders. They are largely chemical companies. Dow DuPont. Kim China is the name of the one that owns Syngenta now, you know, and so and Bayer is a chemical company that bought Monsanto, right? So
the aspirin people, no less, right?
Well, what they've done up to now is help keep their profits high by genetically engineering new varieties that needed chemicals. You know, they're Roundup ready. That's still the largest share of all the biotech crops that have been produced, that are being planted. It's like 70%, last time I looked, are all Roundup ready. And so what it means is that Roundup sales have gone through the roof. And now that we've created millions of acres of Roundup-resistant weeds by constantly spraying Roundup everywhere, and the weeds are starting to get super smart, now we have dicamba-ready crops. You know, they've had to go to a more insidious form of pesticide that we got rid of.
So now you need glyphosate and dicamba.
Right. So they call it star stacker. They're starting to stack these genetic traits into the new variety. So we do know they're doing that. Now, one of the things they've consistently done all the way through is talk about 9 billion people or 10 billion and this incredible need to feed people, which is, as I said, a myth. At best, they're only feeding 30%. Most of those biotech crops are being used, actually a majority are being used for biofuels and not even being used for food, or they're being used to feed animals. They're not being used to feed humans directly. So the amount that they grow to feed humans is relatively small. And we know in the industrial companies, half or more of that food is wasted in their industrial system. So their actual impact on what we eat is really relatively small, but they always talk in big, you know, we're going to feed the billions of people. And then they throw out, and I've heard this now for 25 years, they throw out some big new breakthrough. Oh, we're going to biotech engineer drought tolerance, or we're going to biotech engineer crops that can survive heat waves or floods, or whatever new thing comes down the pike. Though that's the future. Well, we have yet to see any of those crops.
It's like the proverbial cure for cancer that you hear once a week, every week, forever. Folks, this is Food Chain. One more quick break. We come back with Bill McDorman, who is the Seed Man, Executive Director, Rocky Mountain Seed Alliance, and storyteller extraordinaire. And when we come back, I'm going to ask him the big question is, can we get 1 million people to start saving their own seeds? And if we do, does that mean we can save the future of our food? This is the Food Chain radio program. We will be right back after these important messages. Please do stay tuned. Bill McDorman, right back.
So much to say, so little time to say it on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, folks, Bill McDorman says we can save the future of our food by saving our seeds, and he wants 1 million of us to start saving our own seeds. Now, it sounds like a lot of work to me. I mean, after all, I'd have to start paying attention. Is that where it starts, Bill?
Well, paying attention in the sense that your garden's probably already naturally saving some seeds. Some things are going to seed. Those seeds are dropping on the ground. We all know volunteers work better. So you're a seed saver and you don't even know it. You just have to learn to recognize these systems and what's going on. And to learn to do that's pretty easy. And so here's what we've done. We started a new seed conservation organization. Up until now, most of the ones that I've been involved with, I was the director of one, have been raising money, even millions of dollars, to take care of collections of seeds that they've saved. And they say it's really important for us to save these. And it is. But that's not going to get us down the road. So Rocky Mountain Seed Alliance was started with a different idea. Let's turn that idea on its head, and instead of trying to save seeds, let's teach everybody how to save their own. So we started a program called Seed School, 6-day program. We still do some of those. That evolved into a 1-day seed school. We've done tons of those now over the last 8 years. In fact, we've graduated over 1,000 students now from those two programs. And then we got another idea. Let's do Seed School teacher training. Let's train people how to teach the seed schools that we're doing. And now we've trained over 100 seed teachers to go out and teach their own seed schools. And so if we've graduated over 1,000 people in a few short years, and each of them go out, well, we're already at 100,000. And if they start teaching people how to do it, well, you can see how it wouldn't take long in an exponential way to get to 1 million. So if you want to learn how to do this, come to the RockyMountainSeeds.org website, sign up for e-alerts. We'll keep you in we'll keep you alerted to what we're doing and what our schools are. We actually have a seed school online now. So if you can't get away and do a school, you can take the best of what we've been doing in a 7-part webinar. And so, you know, we're at that hockey stick. You know, we're in the flat part of the hockey stick. But we're laying a big base, and in less than 5 short years, we've made a huge impact and become a model for other people in other regions. You know, we're the Rocky Mountain Seed Alliance. I don't know how to save seeds in Florida. I don't even know how to plant them. I've never gardened there. So somebody down there needs to get a whole southeastern regional thing going and do the same thing. Put all your energy into inspiring and teaching people how to save seeds. That's our focus, and that's what we do with everything people donate to us. And we need donations to run. That's how we run. We're a nonprofit. And then we give away all the information, all the webinars, all the written materials.
Where do we send money?
Produce. Well, RockyMountainSeeds.org, there's a donate button. Simple as that.
Now, let me ask you one quick last question. Which is most effective way to affect change in the world? By becoming a politician or by saving the seeds?
Yeah. Well, I think top down. You know, as Paul Hawken, who is one of your Bay Area guys, said rather eloquently to me about 20 years ago, I read this. He said, you can't save elegant systems from Command Central. You can't run them. You can't save them. The world I want to live in is elegant. It's rich diversity with tons, as you called it, character. The only way to do that, folks, is from the bottom up. You know, saving seeds has to be a grassroots movement because that's the only way to get enough diversity. You get millions of people saving seeds, we're going to get a lot of diversity.
Bill
no
McDormand.
No institution's ever going to do that.
Bill McDormand, thank you so much. RockyMountainSeedAlliance.org?
.org.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.